Blog Talk Radio.
Time for the next edition of the Riveting Jumbo Justice Radio Show, broadcast worldwide on Blog Talk Radio. Turn up your speakers and listen closely, since you may be asked questions later. Keep your phone handy, since we encourage you to call in your comments to the host and guests on today's show. The listener call-in number is 347-996-5983. Once again, the number is 347-996-5983. You will also find the number on the top of the homepage for the Jumbo Justice Radio Show. I'm Audrey, your technical and spiritual advisor for the radio broadcast. And now, without further delay, allow me to introduce your eminently qualified and inspiring host for Jumbo Justice, Professor Keith Haley.
Thank you so much, Audrey. Welcome to Blog Talk Radio and the Jumbo Justice Radio Show. I want to pay special tribute to Audrey this evening, since it's Thanksgiving Eve and she has friends and family that she'll be attending with later and celebrating the holidays here on Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. So thank you very much, Audrey, for staying around tonight to help us host the show. Welcome to Blog Talk Radio. I'm your host, Keith Haley. We want to thank Hank Snow again for that marvelous introductory number. I want to wish everybody happy Thanksgiving. I often think about Thanksgiving. I think of that sign that I've seen in Texas prisons. It says, count your blessings and then recount them. You may have missed some. Well, that's probably true for all of us. We're very fortunate to live in the nation and the communities that we live in, and we enjoy so many blessings. And I want to be sure to remind some folks about Conservative Justice Digest. I've had a couple of questions about that. Some of the articles that, for example, the authors of the book Strange But Real Perspectives on Odd Issues in Criminal Justice, some of those authors' articles are actually on the Conservative Justice Digest site. And if you would want to look at those and read them and comment on them, actually, since it's blog site capability, it has blog site capability, you can go to http://conservativejusticedigest.blogspot.com. Let me say that again. http://conservativejusticedigest.blogspot.com. And there you can see a number of articles published by various people, some of my own. And you can also see the fine articles that are being submitted in the book for the book Strange But Real, which will be published and for sale probably about mid-January, if not a little bit earlier. Now, I did notice today you can't help but avoiding the traffic news that streets and highways are crowded. No kidding. I'm hearing that about 38 million people are going to travel at least 50 miles to get to their Thanksgiving Day destination. And be careful out there. I guess if you're flying, it's a little bit worse. You need to bring a weak supply of Ziploc bags, apparently, in order to carry your liquids and some of these other things that they're asking you to be very careful about carrying on airplanes. Can't even imagine flying on Thanksgiving weekend, but millions do. I also wanted to bring up a site to you and pass along to you something that's very interesting to me. I read the article about it in the New York Times, and some of you recognize the name Darren Kagan. Well, Darren Kagan has a new website and a new production, and it's the DarrenKagan.com website. I'll give you the exact designation in just a moment. But the motto on her site is to show the world what's possible. If you haven't had a chance to take a look at this site, you really should. It's a website that every member of the family can enjoy because there are positive stories on there about things going on in the world that are good and decent. Many stories of success. The story today that will pop on automatically in video when you come on today is about a an immigrant from Ethiopia who came into the United States. He's been here a little over 10 years. He's ended up a successful businessman, and in order to give back, he's returned to Ethiopia and seen so much devastation and ruin there and poverty, and he's actually generated the funds to build a hospital there, and he's not done yet. There's other things that he wants to do there, but there are many, many stories there about children with illnesses and all sorts of other positive things that the site is updated regularly, and it's also a very attractive website. So here's the address for that. It's www.darrenkagan.com, and Darren Kagan is spelled DarynKagan.com, DarynKagan.com. DarrenKagan.com. I think you'll really enjoy that website. For those of you who might be a new listener, let me tell you what the show is about. We discuss news, issues, events, and developments in the always difficult and sometimes humorous practice of criminal justice. And there's certainly a lot to talk about tonight, as there is every week in the field of crime and criminology and criminal justice. And we dedicate this show to the tireless police and court corrections and juvenile justice professionals who protect us throughout the United States and indeed throughout the world. I want to pay special tribute to our Secret Service agents tonight. They're taking a little bit of a whopping in the media today because of a couple of things that happened. One of them, I guess a couple of agents in Argentina were not able to prevent one of the president's daughters from being robbed. And they took her cell phone, I think, and purse and some other things, but we'll have to get more details about that particular event. But the Secret Service and many of the other federal agents provide marvelous security for our public officials, not only in the United States, but, of course, throughout the world. Let me comment one more time about Blog Talk Radio if you're new to the technology. It is certainly something that's very forward-thinking. Alan Levy is the CEO of Blog Talk Radio, and he's brought this enterprise from one show about 3 months ago to now perhaps more than 1,600 radio shows. And what Blog Talk Radio allows you to do is that any person or interest group, your concerns can be repairing bicycles to skeet shooting to bird watching, whatever that might be, you can have your own show. You can broadcast live and streaming audio over the Internet worldwide to an unlimited number of listeners. Isn't that incredible? And guess what? It's all free. And you're permitted to broadcast as much as, and perhaps more with permission, 14 hours a week or 2 hours every day. But isn't that incredible? Just five, 6 years ago, the opportunity to have a radio show on the Internet was very limited, and your broadcast hours were limited severely, and of course your number of listeners was limited. But as the technology advances, now we have something such as Blog Talk Radio. So as I've said before, like similar to the motto, sales slogan on Cheez-Its box, get your own show. You can certainly do it with Blog Talk Radio. Let me tell you what's going to be on the show tonight. It's going to be a follow-up of a few things that we've started in earlier shows, and particularly last week. Of course, I'll be commenting on some things relative to the news. And this first story I have tonight, you almost wouldn't believe. It has to come from the European Union. I hope you can contain yourself when you hear this one. Audrey will be assisting me now and then throughout the show. If we have time, we may even let her comment on a news article. I also want to follow up to Jim Fernison's fine commentary last week about the Ohio Minutemen Project, and I wanted to spend some time on my own research where I actually visited the southwest border south of Tucson and conducted a research project down there in 2005, just after the Minutemen completed their incredible deployment in April of 2005, where they all but brought illegal immigration to a halt in a matter of three weeks. I also want to make mention the fact that if you're in Ohio, and particularly in southwest Ohio or southern Ohio, you may want to attend a meeting of the Ohio Minutemen Civil Defense Corps, and that's their November meeting. It's going to be on November 29th at 7 p.m., and we'll be at the Middletown Sportsman's Club, and that's at 6943 Michael Road in Middletown, Ohio. And you can call Jim Fernison if you need more information about that. He can be called at 937-623-7381. Or you can email him at, this is kind of a tricky email address, so pay attention, mmofohio@yahoo.com. So it's mmofohio@yahoo.com. And that would you be contacting Jim Fernison, who's the head or director of the Ohio Minutemen Civil Defense Corps project. The other thing I'll be doing tonight is doing a little bit of a book review on Pat Buchanan's really outstanding book, State of Emergency. I don't know if you've had a chance to take a peek at that book at the bookstore or to buy it yourself, but I know that Jim Fernison had read it also, and it's an outstanding book, and it's one of the few books that I couldn't restrain myself from going to the last chapter almost immediately after I started it, because there is Pat Buchanan's plan of what we have to do, and I think you'll enjoy hearing about what he has to say. One thing about Pat Buchanan is that when you read one of his books, you do not leave it doubting that it's well-researched, because he certainly is a good employer of data and does a good job of describing this data. So the book is called State of Emergency by Patrick Buchanan, and you remember him in previous presidential election running for president. Well, here's what you can do as a listener or a caller. You can listen to the show on your computer, of course, with the Windows Media Player. Or you can call in by telephone, and that can be either by a cell phone. You can do it by landline. And for those of you who haven't discovered the Skype technology, that's S-K-Y-P-E, you can download Skype in literally in a matter of 2 or 3 minutes and be up on the air. And you can call computer to computer by voice on Skype throughout the world, and it will be free forever. But one of the nice things that's going on now with Skype is that you'll be able to call any phone number from your computer. You simply hit a dial pad and dial the numbers, and you can call any number in the United States or Canada clear through the end of December. I don't know what they're going to do in regard to that facility in January, but it's certainly an outstanding thing to do. The number that you call in for our show, as Audrey said, is 347-996 5983, and that's 347-996-5983. And what happens on my host switchboard, I can entertain as many as five callers at the same time, And actually, they can all talk at the same time. Well, not all talk at the same time, I hope, but they can all listen and talk to each other at one time. When it gets beyond five at this point, somebody has to drop off. And beyond that, I think in the future they're going to even have a facility where we can do more than five calls. But that's a pretty nice opportunity for a service that has only been around for 3 months, and it's free. I'm going to start off tonight, since some of you are traveling on the road or will be soon or even tomorrow. This one is almost too incredible to believe. Incredible. I guess that's redundant. Here's the headline. European cities are going to do away with traffic signs. And this is a project brought about by the European Union. They're pushing this. It starts off quoting the famous Russian aristocrat who's the father of anarchism, Mikhail Bakunin. He said that, let's do away with all the rules and the regulations. Here's what they're planning in some European cities, and in fact, it's already implemented in a few. European traffic planners are dreaming of streets that are free of rules and directives. They want drivers and pedestrians to interact in a free and humane way, as brethren, by means of friendly gestures, nods of the head and eye contact, without the harassment of prohibitions, restrictions and warning signs, and they mean traffic lights, etc. In fact, they're even talking about taking the center lines out of the road, so you won't know whose side of the road you're on if you're close to the middle. This project is implemented by the European Union. It's currently seeing seven cities and regions cutting their traffic signs like they're out cutting down a forest. Edgeby in Denmark is participating in the experiment, as are Ipswich in England and the Belgian town of Ostend, I'm not sure how you pronounce that. The utopia has already begun in the Dutch city of Makinga, assigned by the entrance to the small town. It's only a town of 1,000. There are others they're talking about here that are much larger. Reads free of traffic signs. So cars bumble unhurriedly over precision-trimmed granite cobblestones. Stop signs and direction signs are nowhere to be seen. There are neither parking meters nor stopping restrictions. There aren't even lines painted on the streets. The many rules strip us of the most important thing, the ability to be considerate. We're losing our capacity for socially responsible behavior, says Dutch traffic guru Hans Munderman, one of the project's co-founders. The greater the number of prescriptions, he says, the more people's sense of personal responsibility dwindles. Listen up, I have more. Munderman could be on to something. He says Germany has 648 valid traffic symbols. The inner cities are crowded with a colorful thicket of metal signs. Don't park over here. Watch for the passing deer. Make sure that you don't skid. He said the forest of signs is growing even denser. Some 20 million traffic signs have already been set up all over the country. Psychologists have long revealed the senselessness of such exaggerated regulation. About 70% of traffic signs are ignored by drivers, they say. What's more, not telling any traffic officer anything, I'm sure. What's more, the glut of prohibitions is tantamount to treating the driver like a child. And it also foments resentment, he says. He may stop in front of the crosswalk, but that only makes him feel justified in preventing pedestrians from crossing the street on every other occasion. Every traffic light baits him with the promise of making it over the crossing while the light is still yellow. Really, I never thought about that myself when I was driving. I always thought the traffic control devices were necessary. He said the result is that drivers find themselves enclosed by a corset of prescriptions so that they develop a kind of tunnel vision. They're constantly in search of their own advantage, and their good manners go out the window. The new traffic model advocates the belief that the only way out of this vicious circle is to give drivers more liberty and encourage them to take responsibility for themselves. They demand streets like those in the Middle Ages. Are you listening? When horse-drawn carriages, hand carts, and people scurried about in a completely unregulated fashion. The new model's proponents envision today's drivers and pedestrians blending into a colorful and peaceful traffic scheme. A colorful and peaceful traffic scheme. I wonder if this guy's ever read anything about the history of the automobile in the United States, at least. And, you know, somebody in a town got the first car, and then there were two, and then there were four, and then they started running into each other and people, and it wasn't long, in a couple of years, that we began to think about having traffic laws and rules and somebody to enforce the law. He says, well, it may sound like chaos, but it's only the lesson drawn from on the insights of traffic psychology. Drivers will force the accelerator down ruthlessly only in situations where everything has been fully regulated. Where the situation is unclear, they're forced to drive more carefully and cautiously. I'm sure that this particular traffic psychologist or this commentator has not been on the belt going around Dallas, where you can be passed at 140, 150 miles an hour just about every day if you want. Indeed, unsafe is safe was the motto of a conference where proponents of the new roadside philosophy met in Frankfurt in mid-October. So they're just a month off of their conference, and their motto is unsafe is safe. How's that for some twisted logic, at least in my mind? True, many of them aren't convinced of the new approach. One commentator is from Schretzenberg, from Duisburg University, says that German drivers are used to rules. They actually like them. Here we go. The road will be refurbished. This is a town in Lower Saxony. Using EU funds, the sidewalks are going to go, and the asphalt's going too. Everything will be covered in cobblestones. I don't know if you've ever had the pleasure of riding down a cobblestone street at any degree of speed in a small car, but you certainly won't have any trouble digesting your previous meal because it's not comfortable. And it's good for the auto mechanics and the spring and shock business. The plans derive inspiration and motivation from a large experiment in the town of Drachten in the Netherlands. This town has 45,000 inhabitants. Their cars have already been driving over red natural stone for years. Cyclists dutifully raise their arm when they want to make a turn, and drivers communicate by hand signs, nods, and waving. Can you imagine some of the hand signs in the United States? Okay. More than half of our signs have already been scrapped, says traffic planner Koop Kerstra. Only two out of our original 18 traffic light crossings are left, and we've converted them to roundabouts, in other words, traffic circles. Now traffic is regulated by only two rules in this city. Here are the rules. Yield to the right, get in someone's way, and you'll be towed. That's right. Yield to the right and get in someone's way, and you'll be towed. Strange as it may seem, in this city, the number of accidents has dramatically declined. Experts from Argentina and the United States have visited Drachten. Even London has expressed an interest in this new example of automobile anarchy, and the model is being tested in the British capital's Kingsington neighborhood. We'll have to see what happens in this regard, but I'm surprised that something like this could actually go on, and I don't know what happens when you have a traffic fatality and trying to figure out, you know, who was the offender. I'm sure lawyers will sort that out for us no matter what nation or what planet we're on. This next story is a very interesting one, and I played this videotape, such as it was, concerning a University of California at Los Angeles, a UCLA police officer who was called to the library about 11 o'clock at night, and there was a gentleman in there where a library employee had asked him to identify himself. And I'm not sure what those circumstances were, and nobody said what they are, at least at this point, from any news account that I've read. But what happens in the course of this, he refuses to identify himself, and he says he's a native-born U.S. citizen, of Mideast descent, and he thinks it's a product of him being singled out because of his Mideast descent and some of the fear that's resulted from 9/11 and from Islam and radical Islam, that sort of thing. So what happens is they call the campus police, and two campus police officers show up, and they ask him for the ID, and they ask him to leave the library. He doesn't do that. And finally, they ended up shooting him with a stun gun. And you can see this video. Just type in UCLA Taser on Google Video or YouTube, and you'll be able to watch this. It's about a six-minute video taken by a patron of the library, another student, on his cell phone video camera. So you can't see everything, but you can probably hear a good bit of the conversation. So what ensues from this is he doesn't do that, and they keep telling him that, in fact, he goes limp and drops to the floor. He tells them that he was leaving, but he goes limp, and they keep telling him to stand up. I mean, they keep telling him to stand up. I didn't count it, but it must be 25, 30, 35 times, and I don't know how long it took them to figure out that that command wasn't working. But they ended up shooting him several more times with a stun gun. And then finally, at the end of this, probably 5 minutes into this videotape, you see that they do what I thought many police officers would have done years ago anyway, is they keep him down and they handcuff him and they drag him out of the library. Well, of course, he's got an attorney, and University of California at Los Angeles has decided to conduct an investigation of this. They're not condemning the police officers at this point because, as I'm saying, as I wasn't there and I can't tell from a video and from the audio all that was going on, but it seems like there was a shorter solution to this than tasing this guy or taserizing this guy, whatever the term is, numerous times before they finally decided to take a hold of him and drag him out. It's not a real good analogy, but it's at least it's linked somehow to the case of Rodney King back in the early 1990s, where they struck him with the baton 56 times and tasered him twice, and eventually a bunch of them jumped him and took him into custody, which I would have thought that many corrections officers and a lot of street doctors would have figured that out to use the swarm technique earlier. But anyway, you know what resulted from all that. So it'll be interesting to see. I'm sort of fascinated with the taser. It's either one of the best things that's ever come along in police work, or it's one of the most confusing things at the moment. And these students at the University of California, they want to be part of this investigation. And they certainly are interested, it says in an article I just got out of the Chronicle of Higher Education, they want to be involved in reviewing the campus policy on the use of the taser. And I know there are police departments that have clearly said that this taser has, in fact, cut injuries down on their police officers by as much as 50%. In fact, I had a student do a research project on that a couple of years ago, and it's reduced injuries on citizens and police officers 40 to 50%. What we see, I think, on some places like YouTube and Google Video are some of the worst examples of the use of the taser. And I'm not saying this is one of them, but go take a look at that yourself. And again, you just type in UCLA taser on Google.com and click on video, and you'll see that six-minute video right there. That's an interesting thing to take a look at. I thought this was an interesting story, and I've seen two or three different accounts of it. And I'm reading an account right now, or referring to an account written by Robert Spencer. And Robert Spencer is the author of the book, The Politically Incorrect Guide to Islam. And I don't know if you've seen him on television, but he's a super scholar, and he's been writing about radical Islam for quite some time. And he's referring to this case here where the six imams were taken off. They were on their way to a conference in the Southwest, and they were taken off the flight at the Minneapolis St. Paul International Airport. And what they were doing, there's not unanimity on the facts in this case, but there's two different accounts. They said that they're praying out loud. Some said on the plane at the proper time where Muslims pray several times a day out loud. And they were sitting, six of them, at various locations throughout the plane. And some of the passengers said that they had heard them making derogatory comments about the United States prior to getting on the plane. Now, some others have said that they actually said the prayers before they got on the plane, but there were also these comments. So in light of our concern over 9/11 and radical Islam, and these gentlemen may or may not have been that, I doubt that they were part of the radical Islamic movement, these passengers were concerned. So one of the passengers passed a note to the airline attendant, and it goes up to the pilots, and the pilots decide that let's do something about this. So they take them off the plane, and apparently they called, I believe, the FBI, and the FBI ends up in interrogating them or questioning them for a couple of hours, and then finally they mounted the plane and went back to the I think to Phoenix or someplace like that. But it's certainly a, it's kind of an interesting situation. And they're saying at the Aviation Security Administration that they're using something what they call the but-for test. And here's what they mean that. But for the person's religious orientation in this case, would they have taken the security procedures that they actually took? And Spencer is saying, and here I think it's questionable. We'll have to look at all the facts, but you don't want to single people out on unfounded fears or through racial or gender or religious bias. Certainly we don't. In the post-9/11 environment, we have to really be careful about not singling people out and taking them off of airplanes. That's a quote, I'm sorry, from Kenneth Quinn from the Aviation Security Administration. But I think what's happening is this is going to end up a bad precedent. And if it makes us reluctant to, you know, actually do conduct interrogations and inquiries into Muslims who may be engaged in something that we can consider suspicious, I suppose one thing you could do is, unless, you know, if you weren't searched and questioned like this every day, you could just sort of consent to it and realize it's necessary in the interest of public order. But that doesn't seem to be the world that we're living in. So it'll be interesting to see what the investigation reveals in this particular case. But if I were sitting on a plane and six people who I believed were of the Muslim faith and religious imams, and they stood up and started reciting out loud these prayers, I don't know if I'd be suspicious about that or not. I would consider it unusual because it's certainly something I've never seen, but we'll have to see. All right, in the world of cameras, we like to keep track on what's going on in law enforcement and public service surveillance. Here's a really interesting device that's being tested in England right now. Police officers in London have begun to use a camera mounted on their headgear in an effort to tackle antisocial behavior. And I think you realize, and in Great Britain, you can be tagged with a citation for antisocial behavior, and that includes a range of things if people are engaged in what the Russians used to call hooliganism, then you can actually be cited for that. And then the consequences to that, I looked up tonight on the Internet, if you get one of these ASBO antisocial behavior orders, you can actually be cited. You can be given home detention. You can be given community service work type projects, and also levied a fine against you. So anyway, it has consequences, but here's what this thing is like. It fits on the headgear of the police officer. They're using it in 19 neighborhoods in this particular part of England, London. And they've been issued 8 cameras, each the size of a AA battery. They record video images to a special utility belt, and they are activated by a switch on the belt. So when an officer's out on the street, they can see something that they may need to make reference to later on, as part of an investigation or in justifying an arrest or some other behavior or action that they take, they can switch the camera on their belt. And the camera actually picks up images from in 360 degrees, which is amazing. I'm not exactly how that works. Each one costs about 1,800 pounds per pack, and it's funded by the city's council's Council's Safer Communities Partnership. And this will be used to gather images that could be used as evidence in future court proceedings. The video can actually store up to 12, or the camera can actually store up to 12 hours of video, but that requires an extra battery pack. The basic one can take 12 hours of video, and then the extra battery pack can allow it to store up to 400 hours. I'm not sure why that would be necessary if you can recharge the battery. And I'm sure officers don't spend much more than 8 hours on the job, but they were videotaping every moment. But Detective Superintendent Richard Wood says the cameras will act as an excellent deterrent for any youngsters who are intent on causing trouble. So I guess the idea is that you're out there and you turn on your camera, or you threaten to turn on your camera, and youngsters will see that they'll be taped. They can use that against them in court. And here's a comment from the detective superintendent. He says, should anyone commit any offenses, the officers will instantly have the evidence to hand to help them to apply for an ASBO, that's an antisocial behavior order, or pursue a criminal charge. If the cameras prove successful, they're going to be deployed to other units throughout the city, and they want to use them on police raids, and they also want to use them during football or, of course, soccer matches where there's so much rowdiness that goes on as of late. So that's kind of interesting. I think I have no doubt that they're going to be deployed more throughout the nation. I have no question in my mind about that. We're on this surveillance kick, and I don't see turning it back. In fact, I have a much longer article here where people discuss that, and they're saying that many of these communities in the United States and England and perhaps Canada now are getting surveillance systems, and they haven't really thought through what they want to do with them or the potential value. It's just something to do. And these systems don't come cheap, and of course the people that are selling these systems are not certainly not unwilling to provide all the cameras that that they want. On the issue of security, again, and sociability and a lot of other things, Holland is certainly a point to watch around the world concerning its relationship to Muslims. The Netherlands is the first European country to legally ban the burqa, even as Muslims across the continent condemn the new hardening of attitude toward religious minorities. And this is the covering where Muslim women are covered from head to toe, and all you see is their eyes. And it says here that Holland's center-right coalition government, which is up for re-election in the national polls on Wednesday, controversially said legislation would be put in place as soon as possible to ban this head-to-toe garment known as the burqa, as well as all other clothing that covers the entire face of a person. And they're doing this in the interest of security, of course. This comes 9 months after the Dutch parliament voted by a thunderous majority to ban the burqa outright. And it says the vote signaled that Dutch parliamentarians appeared overwhelmingly to agree with the notorious implications of the Netherlands becoming the first European country to ban the Muslim veil. And they're talking about the same thing in England also, and Tony Blair has supported that that idea, actually. The burqa ban is bound to be seen as disconcerting, a first-mover gesture for the continent's 15 million Muslims who are spread across France, the UK, Germany, Belgium, Austria, Italy, Spain, Sweden, and Denmark. They're having elections in the Netherlands now, and the immigration minister, Rita Verdonk, she's called the Iron Rita for her tough approach to the issues of race and immigration. said in a statement that her cabinet finds it undesirable that face-covering clothing, including the burqa, is worn in public places for reasons of public order, security, and protection of citizens. She also adds, from a security standpoint, people should also always be recognizable, and from the standpoint of integration, we think people should be able to communicate with one another. And she's saying that, of course, that means that I should be able to see the person that I'm talking to. It's going to be interesting to see how this turns out, but 150 members of the Dutch Parliament actually voted for this, and it does signal a hardening of attitudes toward the Muslim faith. The main Muslim organization in the Netherlands, the CMO, they've responded, and they've said that